Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Hollis Walker. I'm sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. We're at facebook.com/radiocafemc and on Twitter at radiocafemc. My first guest this morning is Ishwari Salahab, a licensed mental health counselor and author of a new book, Rocks and Roses, a memoir of loss, love, or I said that wrong, of a memoir of love, loss, and transformation. Later on the show, I'll have Carmela Padilla on to talk about her new book out for the 10th anniversary of the International Folk Art Market. So, welcome, Ishwari. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you, Hollis. It's really fun to be here.
So I'm going to give our listeners a little synopsis of your book so they kind of know what we're talking about. The book starts out with the story of your 2.5-year love affair with a man you call Bob in the book and his sudden death of a heart attack on the dance floor at the Rail Yard Performance Center in your presence and the presence of a large number of people. This book includes your sexual and emotional relationship, your poetry, emails you sent to one another, journal entries, things that you found that he wrote about you after he died. It's also the story of your personal transformation, what happened to you after you underwent this terrible loss, and your journey through grief and how it led you to go back to school and become a counselor. And now you've been in private practice. This has all happened quite a while ago. You've been in private practice since 2007. And some of what you do is grief counseling. So tell me why you felt compelled to write this book. You're not, and it's so intimate. You are not exactly a reality TV show sort of barrier all to the world kind of person.
That's right, I'm not. And what... Let's see, what compelled me to write the story, excuse me, is really right from the very beginning, I just received messages in my own heart that this was an important thing to write down. And I was doing it for myself. It was very deeply important to me to pay attention to what was happening. And so I started writing. And I had notes, I had journals, and I think in the back of my mind I always had the idea that there could be a book here. But it wasn't the driving force particularly, but it was very much a part of my process of loss and grief, was the writing of the book and the story.
Yeah. Tell our listeners a little bit about Bob and about what happened that night.
Oh, okay. Well, Bob was a beautiful soul. A very important part of my life. We only had about 2.5 years together, and it was a beautiful relationship. And we met dancing, and he died dancing, literally. That night, it was the 4-year anniversary party for a group that at the time was called Body Choir in Santa Fe, dances at the Rail Yard Performance Center, still to this day. And we were at a point in the dance called chaos.
Appropriately.
And, yeah, that was the, sort of one of the rhythms of the dance structure. And so we were dancing at that point, and he fell to the ground amid 80 to 100 people, lots of music. It was pretty incredible. I saw him on the ground. I went to him, and immediately I knew something was out of the ordinary. And it's all in the book, but he died instantly. And the way I always have seen it is that he basically, a window opened and he flew in.
Uh-huh.
You know, sort of, and it was an ecstatic moment and really pretty phenomenal. And there were many people in Santa Fe there, and so I think many people still remember that. And many people who weren't there were told the story.
Right.
It's not that uncommon for me to... Uh-huh. You know, if I'm telling the story someplace, somebody might say, I remember hearing about that.
Yes. Uh-huh. I've heard about that story. Mm-hmm. It's funny how a profound experience like that can have reverberations throughout a community mm-hmm. so that it becomes a collective experience. It's like any great tragedy that occurs. This was a very personal one in a way, but the larger tragedies of our lifetimes, even if you weren't at you know, the Twin Towers on September 11th, you have definitely been impacted by that event. And in our small way within our community, many people were affected by Bob's death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he also, Hollis, he was what's called a facilitator in that dance structure. And so he was well known to many people and beloved by many.
So he had a large community.
It was very personal to me. It was also very personal to a lot of other people.
Yeah. So one of the things that strikes me in the book is that you have an amazing capacity for ritual. You seem to have a natural propensity to finding and doing rituals that helped you through this process. I want to give a few examples. One of the things, you had water in a bottle that was taken from the dance. It was on an altar at the dance, and you took that. And the first time you took a bath, you poured some of that water into the bath. And then that became a regular practice for you to take these baths and use that as a very concentrated time of mourning Bob's loss. You wore Bob's shirt around a whole lot. You had a bag of his hair that you put in a special, beautiful little sack and placed under your pillow. You wrote, "I love you, Bob," everywhere you went, in the snow, on a Zen board. You slept with a bag of his ashes. So had you always been a person who was a natural at ritual? Or did you even think about these things as you did them as, oh, I'm creating a ritual?
I don't think I really had used a lot of ritual in my life. And really all of those things that you just described, it makes me smile. It was trying to be close to him.
Uh-huh.
It was just very authentically, it just came out of my desire to be close and my desire to be paying close attention to what was going on.
So there is one ritual in the book that might shock some people, and it even shocked you in a way. Tell us about the special coffee and how that came about.
Yeah, okay, well, I did have Bob's ashes, and they were very dear to me. As you said, I would sleep with them. I put little bits of them in very special places. I gave little bits of ashes to friends of his who were traveling to take and disperse where they were. Somebody took some to Tibet. But what you're asking me about is, there was one morning where I was making my coffee, and having coffee together in the morning was one of the rituals, I guess, that Bob and I did. It was just very typical of our mornings together. And so one morning after he died, I was having my coffee, and I just thought, what would happen if I put a tiny little bit of ashes in the coffee grounds, in the coffee maker, and then, you know, just made those with the coffee, and I did it. I think I looked left and right, and it was just kind of like, can I do this? I think it's okay. I don't think it'll hurt me, and it might be really taboo, but here I go. And so I did, and I had coffee with Bob many, many, many times, and I always took the grounds very carefully and put them under my tree because I didn't want them to go in the garbage. But it became a very beautiful, as you said, ritual.
Uh-huh.
And very meaningful, and I don't know where that came from.
Right.
I mean, that just came out of the blue.
I think anybody who has ever lost a spouse or a partner or someone that beloved will recognize in that ritual, even if they didn't do something similar, everyone has found their own way of connecting with or feeling connected to the person who has passed away. And so I found that particularly touching. And as we discussed the other day, you know, I related it in my mind to the Eucharist, because of course Christ said, this is my body, you know, this is my blood. And the taking in of that is the connection and the deep connuncio with, you know, the God, right, with God. So yeah, it was very beautiful. And I want to move a little bit. Well, first of all, let me stop and say I'm talking with Ishwari Salahov, who's the author of Rocks and Roses, A Memoir of Love, Loss, and Transformation. She's a licensed mental health counselor here. And what I want to do is connect your experience, your own personal experience of loss, with what you do now. And one of the things you say is that When a person is suffering, whether it's after the death of someone beloved or a divorce or the loss of a job or whatever brings up deep suffering for us, that we always have a choice. What do you mean by that? What kind of choice? When, you know, you're, you know, in the pits, what choice is there?
Well, you know, you often don't have a choice over what happened. But the choice that I'm talking about, Hollis, is that you always have some degree of choice about how you respond to a loss, what you tell yourself about it, the way that it affects you. And what I've learned largely through this experience of losing my partner, Bob, is that somehow, I think it was just through spiritual grace, I was able to say yes to the experience. I opened into it. I basically made it my job to grieve, to be in each moment. And as I said yes, the experience unfolded in the most amazing way. There were moments where I said no and fought it. And it became more and more painful, and more suffering was involved. You know, there's a Buddhist sort of philosophy about suffering and pain, where pain is kind of inevitable, but suffering is more of a choice. And so when you're able to say yes to what happens in life, you can allow it to change you, and you can grow from it. When you say no and fight and try to keep things the way they were, you know, you can go down that road. It's probably going to be more painful and last longer.
Yeah. One of the things in my experiences in grief counseling that it's important to tell people is that they have to develop a new normal, because nothing goes, it can never be normal again the way it once was after you've suffered any kind of tremendous loss. But you can develop this new normal for you. And that's what you can look forward to in the long term as you adjust to your new life.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's it's part of letting it change you.
Right.
You know, you're going to be changed. This thing was important. This person was important. And it's going to change you. And so your new normal will be the new you.
Right.
And in many cases, the better you.
Right, right. So many people say after something horrible happened, when they have some distance from it, they say what gifts they found within that experience. What about, we talked about authenticity a little bit. How one walks through grief or loss in a way that's particular to you?
Yeah, well, I think back to the coffee, you know. Nobody told me to do that. Nobody told me it was okay to do that. And it turned out to be pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of what worked so well for me in that particular journey was that I was looking to myself to find out what to do. You know, if I felt like laughing, it was okay. If I felt like weeping, it was okay. I needed to rest or be active. It was okay. I guess I took my own counsel.
You gave yourself permission to have your feelings.
To be authentic, absolutely.
And also to laugh. Sometimes people who are grieving feel guilty. When they realize they've gone a whole afternoon and they haven't thought about their loved one, for example, there's this sense of, oh my God, I've forgotten them. But there are times when it's important to just sort of detach and check out from the grief and allow yourself to laugh and have fun.
Yeah, I think that grief takes us to altered states of consciousness and altered states of living. And so we're doing things that we don't have a script for this.
Right.
You know, and even each loss in a person's life, you're not going to have a script for the next one. You know,
right.
It's different. And so just going back to that authenticity,
yeah.
I think is, you know, it's some of the best advice I can give. You know, and people will say things that are helpful. And people will say things that are really unhelpful. And so you need to just begin to sort through that and continually go back to your own heart for your basic guidance. As
right.
well as opening to whatever you see as something larger.
Yeah. It's important, I think. A lot of the time, other people who are well-intentioned and who may love you will start trying to tell you how you should be having your experience or what you should do. You should snap out of it. You need to get out of the house more. You need to do this or that. And I think, can't that actually sort of interrupt your own process?
It can. And I think it's good to take that stuff with a grain of salt. Certainly, to if you can, to see the love, you know, because most of that comes from love and from people just not knowing what else to do. But also, you know, I need to take responsibility for what works for me as the person who's grieving, and not necessarily adhere to, you know, the script that someone else is trying to give me out of just trying to be helpful.
Right. One of the things you talked about in the book is anger and how you were angry sometimes at people who weren't suffering as you were. Tell me about that.
Well, I think in a really significant loss experience, there's a place where you're very alone. I mean, At least 10% of the population is grieving a significant loss at any point. So you're not alone in that respect. But deep, deep, deep inside, no one can walk in your shoes in this moment, in this loss. And so, actually, I forgot what question I'm answering.
I was just asking, heck, I don't know. We were just talking, Ishwari. Yeah, no, that's all right. I was asking you about your anger, getting angry at people who aren't suffering.
Oh, you know? Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. So I became very angry because I felt so alone. I wished there was somebody that could just get how I was feeling. There was a certain amount of disenfranchisement in my situation. We were not married. We weren't even living together. And so there were people who were saying things like, I remember one person said, I told you, you should have tied the knot. And wow. I was livid. It was like, you don't get it. You know, and I remember having thoughts. They were sort of terrifying, murderous thoughts. It was like, I wish somebody would lose their partner too, just like mine, so that they could, you know, I would have a companion in this.
Right.
And, you know, then I had to just give myself permission to have that sort of horrendous thought and let it just run right by. But I felt very angry about not being gotten.
Yeah, and there is a sense of disenfranchisement for many different people, especially, for example, among gay and lesbian people who are partners, if they lose a partner, where much of society doesn't recognize them as partners or the depth of their relationship. And so the remaining or surviving partner doesn't get the attention, the support, the compassion that a spouse in a traditional marriage might get. And also sometimes we have deep experiences of grief when the person we're grieving wasn't necessarily that close to us, but for some reason that relationship and that loss triggers a really deep grieving process. And I think it's important to honor that as well in ourselves. Even if people around us are going, well, she wasn't your best friend, you know, it's like, yeah, but somehow.
You know, that disenfranchisement happens when people lose pets.
Oh, right.
You know, sometimes a pet is a deeply, deeply important love relationship. And people around you might say, oh, well, it's just a dog. Get another dog.
Right.
And that can be very, very, you know, disenfranchising. So that's just another example of the need to point back to your own authentic experience and get support.
So tell me how has your own experience impacted how you work with people as a counselor? Whether they're people having a grief loss, a particular grief loss, or just having problems. How has this helped you be a better counselor?
Well, it brought me to the whole field of counseling in the first place. I never thought about being a counselor until after this all kind of transpired. How does it help me? Well, I think that it helps me to become really present, which is one of the most important things I can offer to somebody as a counselor, as a therapist, is to become very, very present. And to help that individual become present with themselves.
Yeah. So there's a little passage here. Well, I had one thing I wanted to ask you. You had a mantra that you had sort of developed prior to Bob's death, I believe. But tell me about that mantra.
I think what you're referring to is show up, say yes, and tell the truth.
Right.
Yeah, that has been my mantra and still is for a long time. Not mantra in the in you know, like sitting in meditation and repeating it, but just in terms of something I live by. Showing up basically is paying attention to my life, showing up. Saying yes includes saying no, and it includes saying yes to saying no, saying yes to whatever's going on. Basically, embracing the experience of my life, being willing to live my life, and then telling the truth, that's mostly to myself. Mostly telling the truth to myself, but also, you know, it's not always been easy for me to stand up for myself and tell the truth to other people. And so I'm constantly working to do that and to be more skilled at telling the truth, the full truth.
There's a wonderful part toward the end of this book where you, I should mention that Ishwari, it's been a long time since Bob died, and she met a new man and is in a lovely new relationship. And at one point, as she tells us in the end of the book, she was talking to the new man in her life about what she and Bob had shared in their relationship. And this is so beautiful. Ishwari, I just want to ask you to just read this part right here, if you would.
Okay, thank you. I'd be happy to do that. So I told him, this is my new partner, about the ideas Bob and I had shared, that ultimately love is not a commodity or something we can own in measured amounts. It's not something to hoard or dole out to those we deem worthy. Instead, it is divine energy, a field we always have access to. The love we tend to experience as exclusive in a romantic relationship is actually the same love we feel when we love a friend or see a beautiful sunset or have an ecstatic experience of the divine. When I say I love you, I might better say, when I'm with you, it is easy for me to open my heart and enter into the field of love.
Ishwari, thank you. That's really beautiful. I've been talking with Ishwari Salahub. She's the author of Rocks and Roses, a memoir of loss, love, loss, and transformation. I keep saying that backwards. Sorry, Ishwari. And she's a licensed mental health counselor here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with me. We're going to take a break. Please stay tuned to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Hollis.
Hi, we're back here on the Radio Cafe. I'm Hollis Walker, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. My guest now is Carmela Padilla of Santa Fe. Carmela is a longtime community volunteer, and she has a new book out in time for the 10th anniversary event at the International Folk Art Market, which is this weekend. The book is called The Work of Art, Folk Artists in the 21st Century, inspired by the Folk Art Market, but about a lot more than that. Welcome, Carmela.
Thank you, Hollis. Good morning.
I'm so glad to have you here. Carmela and I have known each other for so long.
We have. This is wonderful.
Yeah, it's very nice to see you again. So before we get too far into this, let's talk just a little bit about the Folk Art Market and what happens this weekend. There might be somebody out here in the audience who hasn't been to Folk Art Market or doesn't know much about it.
Well, if you haven't been to Folk Art Market, now is your wonderful opportunity to attend the 10th anniversary of the International Folk Art Market. This weekend begins on Friday evening. Begins on Thursday evening with a big event at the Rail Yard, a free community event at the Rail Yard Park, where we'll have all of the artists convened who will show at this year's market, 190 artists from 60 countries. They will come together to celebrate the opening of the market. There'll be music, food, all kinds of things. For the weekend, we'll shift over to Museum Hill. The big event in terms of the sales and exhibition of folk art through the weekend will be on Saturday and Sunday, beginning at 7:30 with the early bird market, and continuing through 5 o'clock on Saturday. On Sunday, I believe it's from 9 to 5. It's a little bit of a different time on Sunday. So it's a great event. It's a time to come together, celebrate the creativity of Santa Fe and the cultures of the world.
Thanks, Carmela. And you can go to the website, folkartmarket.org,
yes,
and get all the details. It's a great site. It has everything.
You can get tickets. You can print them out. You can buy them. You can get every bit of information you need to know about the market there.
And also today, the Santa Fe New Mexican published its annual guide to the market. And so you can peruse the guide and then get it out of the newspaper, peruse the guide and figure out whose booth you want to make a beeline for once you get there.
Correct. And thanks to the New Mexican for that. They've been doing that service for the International Folk Art Market since its inception.
Back to your book. It's so beautiful. 200 gorgeous images and so many interviews with artists and much, much more than just the story of the Folk Art Market. But I want you to tell us how you got involved with the Folk Art Market.
Well, my journey with the Folk Art Market started with the beginning of the market. Judy Espinar, who many credit as a visionary of the market, who's a dear friend of mine, called me and asked me if I would attend a meeting to talk about the possibility of having a marketplace in Santa Fe. And this was something that would be, was kind of a takeoff of a show she used to have in her gallery shop in Santa Fe, the Clay Angel, which was a pottery shop. And so I said, okay, I'll come to a small meeting and see what's going on. And we started a discussion. Judy and the other co-founders of the market, Charlene Cerny, who's the former director of the International Folk Art Museum of International Folk Art, Charmaine Allred, who's a dedicated arts supporter in Santa Fe, and Tom Augustin, who's a global cultural entrepreneur. At the time, he was the head of the Museum of New Mexico Foundation. And then a lot of community volunteers who, you know, got their antenna up about the idea of bringing folk artists to Santa Fe.
And you kind of owed Judy a favor, I recall.
Yeah, I owed Judy a favor. I was working way back when on the launch of the Museum of Spanish Colonial Art, and that was between 1998 and 2001, and we were planning a big gala grand opening for that event, and we needed some just really dynamic decorations, and I said, I just know the lady who could help us envision this. I went to Judy. I said, could you come to a meeting? Help me, help us envision a way to decorate this, launch this museum in the way we need to do it. And in true Judy fashion, she really kind of took over in a wonderful way and helped us celebrate that opening so wonderfully. And so it was so funny because my husband said to me after that night, well, you know, there will be payback because she did this completely as a volunteer. And 2 years later, sure enough, I got the call to come to this folk art market meeting.
And the rest is history. And the moral of this story is, don't take a meeting. Or do, because what an amazing part of your career the folk art market has come to be.
Absolutely.
I mean, you've been a volunteer with the market all these years.
Yes.
In the beginning, you did publicity, and then you've fulfilled many different roles.
Yes.
As you have elsewhere in the community. I mean, many people out there may know you from your involvement with the Spanish Colonial Art Society, with the rail yard, and you sat on many boards with the development of the rail yard and in many other capacities here. And you're still on the International Folk Art
Foundation
Board, right?
Correct, yes.
So, yeah, I don't know when you had time to write this book, but
well,
before we go too far, I want to put something out there. The people at Folk Art Market have given us a promotional giveaway to give to somebody on the air, and so let me tell you what this involves. This involves what you're going to get in your goodie bag if you're the winner is 2 adult tickets to the International Folk Art Market for Sunday. That's this Sunday, July the 14th. You're going to get a copy of this beautiful book of Carmela's, The Work of Art, Folk Artists in the 21st Century. And you're going to get an eco-friendly water bottle with the International Folk Art Market insignia on it. And that's important because when you're walking around up there during market, it's usually really hot and
that's
you need
right.
some water. So if you would like to have this fabulous promotional packet, I'm going to invite you to call the station. Call 428-1382, and the first caller is going to get that wonderful giveaway package from the International Folk Art Market. So, dialing now. So tell me about how this book came about.
Well, we've talked about a book since the beginning of the market. I guess we could say there have been mumblings about a book. But, you know, a book is a big endeavor, and it really wasn't the right time until we started to look at 10 years of this market. And most people say to me, I can't believe a decade has gone by, and it has. It's gone by fast and famously and furiously. And so in late 2011, Charlene Cerny, then the executive director of the market, and Judy approached me about getting serious about doing a book. And it went from there. And it was a really incredible journey and a lot of fast work. I'm hoping I'm not demeaning my work by saying that, but fast work in the sense that we wanted to make this deadline to celebrate the 10th anniversary. And of course, we wanted to celebrate the market's legacy, but more than that, we wanted to celebrate the legacy of folk art in the world and the legacy of living artists who are continuing to work as folk artists in the world.
So you just started working on this last year?
I did, yes. I guess you could say, I mean, in earnest. I've been working on it for many years in a way, since having been involved with the market. I mean, that was a great groundwork for me. So I already was familiar with the market. I was familiar with so many of the artists. Since I had done the PR and marketing for the first 2 years, I knew a lot of the histories, and I knew the impact of the market over time. And the idea was really not to talk about do a book about the market per se, but about the market's bigger vision and the market's bigger contributions to the world through folk art.
And was that bigger vision? What is that bigger vision? And did it exist from the very beginning, those very early meetings that you had?
It did. The vision was, first of all, to honor living artists who are creating folk art in communities still where folk art has very deep roots, very long time traditions. to honor artists, to help them preserve their traditions, which are really endangered in a modern world. You know, people more and more, not only in the Western world, but throughout the world, are becoming more dependent on disposable goods. The environment is being ravished everywhere. Ravaged everywhere. It's early. you know, there are a lot of challenges that people in the developing world are facing. And so the vision was to help preserve age-old handmade traditions, to communicate the values of that, and also to sustain communities today, help cultures, help with cultural preservation and cultural heritage preservation today.
The market has had so many different impacts. Talk a little bit about the financial impacts. What does the market mean for those who participate, the artists?
You know, it's not an understatement to say that the market transforms lives, and you hear that over and over again. And it's one thing to hear it from the market as a promotional tagline. I heard it from the artists' mouths last year over and over and over again about how their lives have changed so profoundly by coming to Santa Fe, participating in the market. I'll give you one example. The Silkies of Madagascar, a small weaving cooperative from Madagascar of 90 women who have been weaving with silk for generations but have never really made money off of it. They came to the market beginning 3 years ago, I believe. The first 2 years, they made a little bit over $30,000 each year, and this is in the course of 2 days. And in their country, it would take 15 years for them to earn that much money to sustain their communities and to regenerate this silk weaving tradition that they've been regenerating now as a result of the market. The market, also just as a little segue, as part of the 10th anniversary, has done a film on the Silkies of Madagascar, which people will also be able to view at the market this weekend. But that's just one example of impact. There's a lot of impact that is not financial, that helps to elevate people's self-worth and sense of dignity in their communities. People have gone back to their countries after being at the market and had new levels of respect in their community that they may not have enjoyed before. There's a lot of gender inequality, of course, in developing countries and communities worldwide. And many people have been empowered by giving themselves a way to support themselves and their communities and to rebuild their communities that have not been able to be supported over many years. In terms of bigger impact, over the past 10 years, over $16 million has been taken home by artists and their organizations. And that may not sound like a lot in Western terms, but in developing countries especially, there's a multiplier effect that extends to hundreds of people.
So the financial impacts are really amazing. And those numbers, as you said, they don't sound big to us, but to people in developing countries, it can make the difference between utter poverty, abject poverty,
absolutely,
and feeding their families and preserving their traditions and being able to continue them. Tell everybody about how you went about doing all these artist interviews last year.
Oh my gosh, I parked myself last year at the Flying Star Cafe down in the rail yard because the artists who come to the market stay at the Sage Inn. And so the rail yard is an area where they walk around a lot. I set up lots of interviews prior to the event, and people just streamed through Flying Star over probably 5, 6, 7 days. And I did over 35 interviews in about 5 days with artists. You know, and these interviews were 2-3 hours long. So it was a very long week, and it was a really stimulating week. And if there's anything that will inspire you to write a book, it's sitting down with artists from around the world. I mean, it really was a cross-cultural conversation, literally and figuratively. Sometimes I had translators who accompanied the artists to help us out. It was really wonderful, and I was just so grateful that they took the time.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. It tiring, fun. But and lots of tea or coffee imbibed, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Another thing is that I'm wondering about the cross-cultural influences. You bring together all of these people from all over the world who otherwise would probably never meet one another, never see one another's traditions. What did the artists tell you about how that's affected them?
You know, the artists, I guess the biggest surprise for me was I kept thinking that the first thing everybody was going to say was, to talk about was economic impact, because that is so vital. But so many people spoke first and foremost about coming together with people from around the world. Seeing that there were folk art traditions in other parts of the world that were similar to their own traditions, or whose history was similar, and looking at each other's artwork, seeing the beauty and the craftsmanship and the skill that is involved, and getting very inspired from other artists in a creative way. So there is so much creative cultivation, if you will, at the market among artists, and friendships that are made. There are bonds for life that are made at the market. I had one artist from Laos tell me that, you know, now they communicate via email, you know, year round, and they feel like they may be in a small community in a developing world, so they go back from the market, back to a very small, isolated place, but they have support system now around the world from other artists, and they have new stimulation and new ideas and new reason to preserve their art forms. In many of the communities where people live, their art forms are not appreciated as art. The artist is not necessarily revered. That's not true across the board, but in many, many communities that's true. And when they come here and they see the kind of honoring that they have from the public and as well as among each other, it's really, really powerful for them, and it's a major reason that they want to keep creating and keep preserving these traditions that might otherwise be lost.
You said the other day when we were talking that there's sort of this love fest that goes on up at Market.
Yes.
And yeah, and I have to say it's a very interesting thing to be a part of and to witness, because not only are the artists meeting one another and falling in love with each other's work and making friends, but, you know, the people who come to buy from them have such incredible interactions that it's just sort of this love fest.
It's absolutely a love fest. It sounds almost corny, it's such a love fest, but it's true. It's such energy that's going on up there. There's just this energy that just does not stop if you're on a high for 2 days. And yet, there's a bridging between communities, but also, you know, there's a real breakthrough in terms of perception. Even our perceptions here of countries from around the world and people from around the world, you know, those often misinformed perceptions are shared by people around the world. But when you come together and you actually have an experience versus viewing each other through these perceptions of politics and media and controversy that we tend to focus on the day-to-day, it's hugely transformative. And so you have people who may not get along in their home countries, or may not, you know, they may share a border, but they never communicate. They come here and literally the borders are broken down, if even just for 2 days, because they are put together in a place that is not judging them on those merits or any of those kinds of facts of life. The point of this market is to judge them on beauty, craftsmanship, preservation of tradition, and the richness of cultural heritage.
I think that's especially true about our Americans' perceptions of African peoples.
Absolutely.
Because it is the continent we know the least. Very few Americans have ever traveled in Africa, or maybe just to one country. And so we do see Africa as this big, giant unknown, you know, that's described for us in the media largely through events of violence and poverty, starvation, and suffering. And so to meet living people from these cultures with the beauty of their own crafts and their own art, it brings to us to another level of world understanding.
Absolutely.
Our little global village really goes on.
And I've compared it oftentimes to music. They say music's a universal language, but so is art and beauty. And not everybody shares same definition of beauty in the world. Not everybody has the same ideas about beauty. But everybody can find something to connect to in a piece of art created from somewhere around the world.
I wanna mention that I'm talking with Carmela Padilla, who is the author of The Work of Art, Folk Artists in the 21st Century, a new book celebrating the 10th anniversary of International Folk Art Market, which is this weekend up on Museum Hill. And I did want to make sure that we said what a wonderful opportunity this is for families to take their children.
Absolutely. You know, you could never travel around the world enough times to be able to be exposed to all of these artists, to all of these folk art forms, and you've got it all here in Santa Fe. This is a treasure, not only in Santa Fe and New Mexico, but for the whole world.
Does the market have any idea how many people come from elsewhere to go to the market?
I think right now it's estimated that close to 60% of our visitors are from out of town. I think we're getting a little more over 22,000 people a year. That's a lot of people.
Right.
It's not a huge space. But again, it's part of the experience of being in a marketplace. It'll give you the experience of really being in an international marketplace in a country, perhaps, where there's a lot of density. We're not used to that here in Santa Fe, but
right.
It's fun.
I do also want to mention we do have a winner for our giveaway of the tickets and your
yay.
Beautiful book, and that's Denise Cope of Santa Fe.
Great.
And yeah, so I'll be talking to Denise later and telling her how to pick that up.
Thank you, Denise. I hope you enjoy the book.
Yeah, it was a really wonderful wonderful gift of the Folk Art Market to share with us. One of the things that you've said is that the book is also not just something celebrating the market or the folk artists themselves, but a call to social action. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, there's a little bit of an editorial bent to the book, if you will, which was a little bit of a difference for me as a writer. But you know, there is a sense of social responsibility that goes along with buying folk art, if you really think about it. I kind of liken it to buying organic foods, driving energy-efficient cars. People are making choices about how to invest their resources in the world. And when you make a choice to buy a piece of folk art, you're actually making a conscious choice to not only revere an age-old tradition and a handmade tradition, but to help sustain a part of somebody's cultural heritage. And that is very valuable. You get something back because you get a beautiful piece of artwork, but you are also literally making a socially responsible statement about how you want to spend your resources.
So it's a great time to do your holiday shopping.
Yes, it's a good reason.
Get it all done early. A couple of other things I wanted to share with people about going to the market that they may not know if they haven't been before. This isn't like an open air market in Morocco. There's no negotiation.
No,
right?
No negotiation, and that's intentional. Again, this is an artist centered enterprise. It has been from the start. The idea is to elevate the role of the artist in our midst, and so there's no bartering. This is the best, finest master artistry in folk art that you can find.
The show is curated, right?
It's curated. It's expertly curated, you know, by people who are experts in the field. We've got the Marsha Bowl, the director of the Museum of International Folk Art, sits on this curation committee, as well as many, many others who are experts, folklorists, and in the field. And the finest artists who apply are chosen because we want to show that folk art, you know, is an art form to really be revered, and it can hold its own among any other art form.
So Carmela, you have been doing a folk art market for 10 years. Tell the audience how you go about doing it, how you the scheme you've come up with for seeing the most, and because it's cacophonous, it is chaos up there.
It's chaos, and you can get caught in the first booth and and it'll take you years to get through to the last booth. So I think that the good thing to do is if you can pick up a New Mexican guide to the folk art market, they'll have them on the hill if you don't get one beforehand. But study it a little bit. There are biographies of all the artists. There are photographs of the images. Have an idea of what you might like to think about, you know, whether it's a cause you want to support, a country you want to support, and make a beeline for that booth. I mean, you can also just wander around and just see what looks beautiful to you and stop there and talk to the artist.
It's a visual feast, isn't it?
It's a visual feast. It's absolutely beautiful.
And kids are free, right?
Kids are free all weekend. Uh-huh. And, you know, that's a great thing. Kids, oh my gosh, their world can just be expanded so much in one weekend by going to the folk art market. There's a passport program on Sunday that takes place. Kids can actually get a passport. They get stamps. They go around the market, and the artists will stamp their passport, oh. And they will actually travel the world in that one day.
I want one.
Yeah, you can do that.
And the other thing I should mention is that the way you get to Folk Art Market is you don't drive up the hill and park because there are too many people. You get on a bus down at the PERA parking lot.
PERA and other locations.
Uh-huh. It'll be in the guide.
That's right, in the guide at folkartmarket.org. All the details there about getting bussed up. And that's even a fun experience. The market
it
makes
is.
Everything fun.
It's actually a lot of fun. The first year they instituted that, I thought, oh, I'm going to go get this bus. And, of course, you know, I met all these really interesting people, and we had a blast on the bus. So,
right.
Yeah, so that works really well. So now I know, Carmela, that you and your husband, Luis Tapia, who is a sculptor, that you have your own folk art collection.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, we're kind of slaves to art. We have our diverse interests. I love ceramics. That's probably, I'll blame that one on Judy Espinar too. She introduced me to the world of global folk art ceramics through her store and taught me a lot about them. And so I'm a fiend for ceramics and jewelry. And my husband collects Mexican masks. As just a lot of other things.
So it's taking over your house?
It's taken over our house. I've been told I can't buy anything unless I'm getting ready to replace something else because there's no more room.
You have on some beautiful jewelry
Thank
today.
You.
Did any of this come from market?
You know, actually, no. some of this is all example of folk art.
It is all folk art. That's
jewelry.
Why I asked.
But these are actually, and that's a good point. These are antique pieces. These are older pieces. The market is not an antiques market. Mm-hmm. This is a market of living traditions, of contemporary pieces in the sense that they are being made by artists who are living today, and they're representing age-old culture stuff. Mm-hmm.
You told me one story about an artist whose self-esteem and dedication to his own art was really impacted by the folk art market. I'm sorry, I think we're just about out of time. I'm hearing some music in the background there, so I'm going to have to cut you off.
Well, we'll have people read the book.
Yeah, this weekend at the International Folk Art Market, Carmela Padilla will be signing copies of her book. It's called The Work of Art, Folk Artists in the 21st Century. It's got 200 beautiful pictures in it, interviews with something like 100 artists and artist representatives, and you're really going to enjoy it, I promise. And you get to meet the beautiful Carmela as well.
Thank you, Hollis. And can I say the book is available exclusively at the market this weekend. So
oh, right.
It's hot off the press. It's the only place you can get it. It's
yeah, my copy actually smells like the ink, I have to say.
It is that hot off the press.
Right. Thank you so much for being here today, Carmela. I encourage everybody out there to go to the Folk Art Market this weekend. It's an amazing experience. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Hollis Walker. I'm sitting in for Mary Charlotte.